Hey, before we start this episode, just want to remind you that the Fearless Woman's Guide to Starting a Business is available everywhere that you like to buy books, and you can get it in paperback, Kindle, and even as an audiobook. I'll have links on where you can purchase in the podcast notes. Okay, back onto the show.
You are listening to One Broken Mom, a podcast dedicated to raising awareness about mental health, parenting, and self-improvement. I'm the host, Ami Quirconi. One Broken Mom is not a family show. It is intended for adults only and may contain adult language. Sometimes the topics are serious, but you can count on the episodes to be entertaining. Also, One Broken Mom is not offering any psychiatric or medical diagnosis. We're just here giving away useful and important information. So, if you're ready to hear real talk by real people so that we can all get better together, then you're in the right place, and welcome. I have a very special guest today on One Broken Mom. One morning while I was thumbing through my newsfeed, a meme popped up, and it said, "Let's raise children who won't have to recover from their childhood," by Pam Leo. And I thought to myself, I wonder if I can get this woman to talk with me on my show. And so I set out doing research and came across the Connection Parenting website. And I reached out with my request. And it wasn't even 24 hours later when Pam Leo herself replied and said yes. Since then, she and I have spoken on the phone, exchanged many emails and Facebook messages about life, parenting, learning new and important things about ourselves and our lives. But there is no doubt that Pam Leo has changed and affected literally thousands and thousands of lives in her decades of work teaching parents. She's a writer, speaker, educator, and like me, an avid reader and learner. And the famous quote is from her book, Connection Parenting. Welcome, Pam.
Hi, thank you.
So your book, Connection Parenting, it was based on a series that you used to do for about 20 years. And I think the story is completely fascinating and heartwarming. Can you tell everyone about this?
I will. Well, I was a family child care provider. When my first child was born, I knew that I wanted to be able to stay home with her. And I had always had an interest in early childhood. So it was a way to do that. And I just wanted to learn everything I could about child development, about human development, you know, how do we become the best parents we can be. So, you know, on nights and weekends, I just was an avid reader, so I read everything on that topic I could find. And then during the week, it was kind of like having a living laboratory that I got to be with these young children and compare the things I was reading with the things I was experiencing. And I just began sharing that information with my child care parents, with other child care providers, and it just started to grow. And, you know, people kept saying, you need to write a book about this. You need to write a book about this. And I wanted to for a long time, but I just kept knowing I don't have all the pieces yet. I don't have all the pieces yet. And finally, one day I was like, I'll probably never have all the pieces. I should at least share the pieces I have. And that's what became Connection Parenting.
And the book was published in 2005, right?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you had shared with me is that you've done a lot of courses and teaching and training to parents that are actually in the prison and jail system that are incarcerated.
I have. I taught the, well, it was originally titled Meeting the Needs of Children, and it was a 6-week series that I taught at the Maine Correctional Center for 18 years. So I've worked with teen parents. I've worked with parents in recovery. I really worked with parents kind of across the board, and the response to this information has pretty much always been the same. Yeah, all parents really resonate with it.
Right. Now, when you and I were talking back and forth before this interview, you'd shared with me a recording of a class that you did. And one of the things you'd borrowed a metaphor from another author and researcher. And you said that the mind is like being a tape recorder. And since my listeners aren't teenagers, they'll need to know what a tape recorder is to begin with. But can you explain what is meant by that statement?
Well, it's just, it was actually from a book called Predictive Parenting by Shad Helmstetter, and I love that book. And he described that our brains are like a recorder attached to a computer. So children record every single word we ever hear. And then that becomes the programming that drives our behavior. So, you know, any way of recording, whether it's tape recording, we do. We just record every word we hear, and it's permanently stored in our brains. And so that's one of the explanations for why we hear ourselves saying the things to our children we swore that were said to us that we swore we'd never say to our children, but they behave in certain ways, and it pushes that button, and what we recorded just plays.
Yeah. Now, and so the, and I know that it's kind of frustrating as a parent sometimes, is you're like, you can't get away with anything because our kids are observing everything about us and hearing every word. And we all have had that moment where you hear, you know, that small child blurt out a cuss word that you hoped that they hadn't. But this isn't just an inconvenience with children that this is the way the brain works. This is actually how they're learning everything from how to walk, run, speak, but also this is where their emotional development is coming from, is this act of observing and absorbing all of this
recording.
Data, right?
Yep, absolutely. And it's also one of the reasons why the most effective way we have of teaching children, and the most respectful way we have of teaching children anything, is to model that behavior. You know, instead of saying, what do you say? You know, to just always thank children and have them see us always thank people. But they observe what we do. Do we always thank people? No. And when they don't always thank people, we pick them up on it. But they're just doing what they've seen us model. So if we want them to always say thank you, then we would need to model always saying thank you, because they're going to do what we do, not what we tell them.
Right, right. And that's one of the biggest factors that you have in the book and concepts that you have, is this idea of, I mean, you start off the book with talking about respect for the child. So let's talk about what connection parenting means. This is a term that you've developed, and the subtitle on the book is Parenting Through Connection Instead of Coercion, Using Love Instead of Fear. So what do you mean by this definition of connection parenting?
We are born biologically wired to connect with another human being. It's what turns human babies into human beings, is that connection. And we don't thrive without it. Some babies don't even survive without it. It is our biological imperative to have that connection with an adult human being. So, you know, it's a little easier when they're young to, because we're carrying them and we're feeding them, you know, that hopefully that connection gets a strong start, not always, but to carry that connection on, it requires us to treat children with the same respect that we would expect. Because as soon as we're disrespectful to a child, we break connection with them. You know, it's hurtful to them if we treat them in a disrespectful way.
Right.
So really, respect is the basis of connection parenting.
Right. And I love how, too, there was an Irma Bombeck quote or section that you had in there, which is, it's hilarious, which is, you know, we don't talk to our children the way we would talk to our friends. And we do, we more or less dictate to our kids, you know, point and, you know, direct them where they need to go and things like that. And we would never do that if our friend, you know, said something or behaved in a certain way. Why is this a mistake with children to just kind of point them in the direction and tell them everything what to do instead of listening to them a little bit more than we do?
Well, it embarrasses them, and so that's hurtful. And, I mean, what happens when we are disrespectful to children and we break connection, we lose influence. And as soon as we lose influence, we have to resort to coercion because it's all we have left. Now, as long as we maintain connection, children care what we think, how we feel, what we want. They care. But when we break that connection, that influence is gone. So it's in our own best interest as well as our children's to treat them with respect.
Yeah. So what are some examples of coercion parenting? That I know what they are, you know, gone through the book, but but what are some examples? Because I think a lot of people listening are going to realize that most of their childhood is defined by what you're calling this, the coercion, you know, using fear tactics instead of love tactics for parenting.
Right. It's basically using their power and their size to intimidate children into doing as they say. You know, do as I say or I'm going to hurt you. You know, it's basically bullying. It's really no different. That's the message in bullying, is do as I say or I'm going to hurt you. Now, it doesn't necessarily have to mean I'm going to physically hurt you, but it can mean I'll withdraw my love and attention. No.
Yeah.
that's a way of hurting a child, is to do that. So any of those kind of threats of I'm going to break connection with you, I mean, that's the biggest fear children would have, is that a parent would break connection with them. And right. That's the one that parents often resort to when they just don't know another way to resolve the situation.
Yeah. And it feels like, you know, when you sit there and you think about it, so, you know, the spanking, timeouts, the, you know, yelling at them, I mean, all these things, you know, have that instill that a scare, you know, in a child that, oh my gosh, like because that's what kids think about, right? They think about, ultimately, my parent doesn't love me anymore. When they come at them and they scare them or frighten or intimidate them in any capacity, I mean, it's easy for me to tap into that fear, you know, myself, of going like, now I've lost your affection. Now I'm scared that you're going to leave me. I'm scared that, you know, what's going to happen next. And that's an unsettling part of human development and brain development, to have that constant. And I know, it's called like toxic stress, you know, it has an impact on the brain development there. But I know that there's this overwhelming idea that, well, but if I don't do these things, if I don't show my authority, then I'm going to have kids that are spoiled. And so there's that perpetuates the idea that you have to parent through these intimidating factors, but that's not the case, right? We're not going to create spoiled children by suddenly not spanking them or putting them in the corner or, you know, pushing them around in life to get them to behave the way we want to.
That is what spoils them, doing those things. You know, we can't, I mean, you know, I guess the definition of the word spoil, but we don't ruin children with love. Indulgence is another whole concept. You know, that doesn't do good things for children, when we indulge their every wish and whim and don't set boundaries. And, you know, that's a whole different direction. But treating them with respect and love can never do anything bad to them.
And I'm going to laugh with you, because I totally agree. I had that conversation with somebody once before, where the, you know, the words out were like, you know, maybe they're being manipulative. And my response was, love is exactly what you need right now. That there's a root reason for that. If you feel like you're being manipulated by somebody, it's because they're trying to get from you, whether that's an adult or a child, to be honest, they're trying to get something from you that they need. And they're trying to manage and drive your choices, your actions and your emotions in order for them to get that. And so, you know, again, one of your bigger themes throughout this whole, the book here, is that behavior tells us whether a child's needs are met or not. And so,
right. And because, yeah, children don't always have the language, even if they have language, to tell us what they need or what hurts. So they act it out with their behavior, thus acting out behavior. They're trying to communicate that need to us. So if we only react to the behavior instead of being able to respond to the need being expressed by that behavior, that's where it goes all wrong. Mm-hmm. And so being able to just kind of stop. Because we do tend to be reactive because of the recordings we carry. But if we can just, I know people always say, how long does it take to learn to do this? And I say, well, I still find that my old tapes are quicker than my new skills.
Right.
You know, and so that's why the rewind, repair, replay. We have to, that's going to happen. It's just going to happen because we carry those tapes. So we are going to respond in a way that we're not happy with. And that's when we have to stop and say, wait a minute, what I just said to you was hurtful. You know, can we start over and, you know, apologize and start over? And when we model doing that, children will learn that they can do it too. You know, if they react to someone in a negative way, in an unkind or hurtful way, they will learn by our model that they can stop and have to do over.
Right, right. So what are some examples of what a parent should be doing if they notice that their child is misbehaving? You know, we can't, you know, permissive parenting is not something that's, which is the whole let them do whatever they want, because that's not giving a child boundaries. But, you know, sometimes kids do things like hurting another child. What is a parent should do in those situations?
Well, two things on that. One thing I just want to clarify, that when we parent through fear, I mean, permissive parenting is really the parent's fear of losing the child's love. That's really what permissive parenting is. And we can't lose a child's love. I mean, parents have done unbelievable things to children, and they're still loyal and loving to them.
Yeah.
So we need to realize that we really can't lose a child's love. So, you know, being permissive is not in their best interest. But, you know, say a child does hurt another child, to me, that's a time to bring the child in, not send them to time out, but to bring them in closer and just say, you know what, that's not okay to hurt your brother. Can you tell me what's hurting you that made you hurt him? Because I know you wouldn't hurt him unless something was hurting you.
Yeah.
And so it's seeing the best in them, you know, it's giving them a chance to, you know, they know they've done something wrong immediately. They know they're in trouble, and so they're scared, and they can't think well. But if we can calm their nervous system down by, you know, kind of embracing them and bringing them in, which is kind of the opposite of what we feel like doing, because, you know, one of the things I say is, you know, I don't like it when someone I love is hurting someone I love.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what happens when siblings hurt each other. But if we can, you know, help them calm down, and the story will usually come out that there is something really hurting them that we can't see from what we know of the situation. So, you know, bringing them in is really what I have found to be the best way to intervene in a situation like that.
Right. And I think that's that flies in the face of what a lot of adults were taught growing up, which was that if you aren't coming down with some sort of, you know, complete authority of like, that's wrong, and I'm going to punish you for that behavior, like instantly, that sends the signal to the child that they can get away with that behavior. And that's not how you actually change that behavior at the end. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
That's not ever been my experience, that, you know, children think, oh, well, I'll just go hit somebody else, you know. You know, for them to hit, I mean, that's a loss of control on their part. You know, they're little, they don't have a lot of control. And when they lose control, we need to lend them some of ours. And not by controlling them, but, you know, bringing them back to that safe place where they can think well again. And, you know, they knew the second they did it, it wasn't okay,
mm-hmm.
you know. But they just lose control.
Yeah. You talked about something, and it's mentioned in the book as well, and then it was in the class that I listened to as well, which is this concept of discharge, and that's an important piece of, you know, our emotional development, but also just our overall emotional well-being. Can you talk to people about what discharge looks like and what we do today? I mean, we even do it to each other as adults, not just to our kids, when we kind of get in fear and interfere with this very natural and very necessary part of emotional development.
Well, it's a huge, that's a huge topic. The word discharge comes from reevaluation counseling or co-counseling, and it simply means the release of feelings. And it can take many different forms. It can be crying, raging, laughter is often a form of discharge of light fears. I mean, when you hear somebody say something and people laugh and they didn't say anything funny, that laughter is usually a nervous laughter. And often children will get in trouble because they're in trouble and they're scared and they laugh. And then the adult says, oh, you think it's funny? I'll show you what's funny. And then they get in more trouble because of, you know, letting out that nervous laughter. So, I mean, the way that human beings heal from the emotional hurts that happen to us is to release those hurts from our body in some physical way, through crying or raging, laughing, yawning, perspiring, trembling. Those are all ways that we release those from our body. And in order to do that, we need the safety of the attention of another person. If you've ever seen a child fall on the playground, they'll look around to see if anyone saw them fall. And if there's no one there, they often don't cry. But if we do acknowledge seeing them fall, they will often cry and cry and cry, what to us may seem way in excess of what that little fall warranted. But what very often happens is once there is some safety, once there is some attention, they will release not only the tears from this fall, but the stored up ones that they kept inside from when there was no one there. The tears, we don't cry out, we cry in, and they stay stored in there. If you could imagine that a child has a little cup And every tear they don't get to cry out, they cry in. And eventually the cup is going to get full and one last hurt will happen and the whole cup spills over into what we call a temper tantrum. Mm-hmm. And a temper tantrum is never about the thing we did see. That's mm-hmm. just the trigger. It's about all the little hurts that happened that we didn't see that got stored in there until there was just no more room and it comes spilling over. And really all we need to do when a child is having a temper tantrum is just keep them safe. Don't let them hurt you. Don't let them hurt anyone else. And just let it empty out, empty out, empty out until it's released.
Yeah.
And then I call it the rainbow after the storm. If you've ever been with a child who's had a major temper tantrum and it's finally over, they're delightful. They're back to their true nature. They're happy as if it never happened. And it can be perplexing to parents sometimes, like, whoa, how did this happen? But that's what's happened. They're now emptied out and there isn't all that pain. Plus, that pain blocks the channel for connection. You cannot connect with a child who's carrying a lot of pain. It's literally like a plug in a tube. You just can't connect with them until they can empty that out. And once that channel is empty, then the channel is open for the connection.
Right. And, you know, it makes me sad when I think about that, because we think about this in terms of children, but I've seen this happen in adults. So when an adult has been brought up in an environment where discharge wasn't allowed, or, you know, as soon as the temper tantrum was thrown, they were put in a corner or told to calm down or stop crying or any of the things that a lot of people do to squelch, you know, this emotional release, because either that was what they were taught and they can't handle that emotion. Then that's a pattern that adult, you know, that child moves into a teenager, moves into an adult, and you see it happen in people that are in their 40s where they seem like they're even keeled until they're not. And then they just go off the hook. And you realize as an adult, when you're looking at another person, hopefully you do, that the issue is not the issue, right? They're letting it all, they're having an adult version of a temper tantrum.
Exactly. And actually, you just touched on something that we should also touch on, which is our ability to listen to a child cry, to be able to say, I can see you're really hurt. It's okay to cry. I'll listen to you cry. Our ability to do that for our children, once we have this information, will be in direct proportion to how many opportunities we get to empty out our own stuff. That, because if children have a cup, by the time we're an adult, we have a lake of uncried tears, of unhealed hurts. And when children start to cry, it triggers that, and we just want to shut it down. We just want them to stop. We'll do anything to get them to stop crying so it will stop triggering our own pain.
Yeah.
So in order to, you know, be able to be that person for a child, we have to set up places, safe places in our life where we have people who will just, you know, we can say, can you just listen to me? I don't need advice. I just need someone to be with me while I cry.
Yeah. And I loved what you said too before when I heard this was, you know, setting up a conversation with somebody where, because when we're talking with friends, and this is why I'm an advocate for getting a therapist or a counselor to work with you if you want to do some really good hardcore self-improvement, you know, and change. Because like you mentioned, we very easily go back to that tape recorder that's in our head. And, you know, from a neuroscience standpoint, that's a real neural pathway in our brain that was developed. You know, the brain is growing and developing. And so those neural connections are made. So it's not just woo-woo, you know, science here. This is like real biology. And so when we, you know, go back to a very strong connection that's had years to develop, you know, the newer parts are a little bit weaker and stuff. But the act of changing all of that, you know, can be really, you know, really challenging and stuff. So this book, you know, for anybody that's listening to this, you know, we're not just going to have a childhood, you know, parent discussion here. You've said that when people read through this book that they realize that first this applies to them in their life, and you have to kind of get through what you were going through as a child, that this book is going to tease out your own reflection on your life first, and that you'll think about everything that happened to you and it will start to matter. And that's where, you know, a therapist, you know, comes in and is very useful for that, because when we talk with our friends and we start to tell them our problems, you know, they're sitting on the edge of their seat ready to discharge right back in your face, like almost in the middle of your conversation. And so you could suggest that, you know, get a friend, give each other 30 minutes of uninterrupted listening. No jumping in and offering advice. No, you know, doing whatever, right? In order to be able to.
And it's actually easier to start maybe in 5-minute increments because we're so not used to being listened to. We really aren't. And we're also not used to listening. So when I do classes, I will start with a 1-minute each way listening partnership. I'll say, okay, what did it take to get in this chair and be here tonight? You have 1 minute and your listening partner is just going to hear that. They're not going to talk. They're not going to ask you questions, anything. They're just going to listen to you. And so I start with 1 minute. And then by the end of the class, we may have worked up to a 5-minute each way. And then, you know, once you develop some skills around that, then ideally, yes, it would be great to have at least a half an hour a week each way with someone who understands the process and can, you know, and the way that it makes it work is the agreement of confidentiality. Mm-hmm. Not only will I never tell anyone anything you said or did in your 30 minutes, I will never bring it up to you without your permission, because in that safe place might be a great, you know, opportunity to let go of a lot of things. But if you're in the grocery store and you see that person and they say, oh, how did this turn out? That's totally not a safe place. So what makes it work for people is the agreement of confidentiality. And that's what creates the safety.
Yeah.
But it's probably the most valuable thing any two parents can do for each other. There is a new book out called Hand in Hand Parenting by Patty Whiffler, and she is the person I learned this process from. Back in those days, it was called the Parents Leadership Institute. She's in Palo Alto, California. Her work is awesome. I would recommend it to all parents trying to figure out how to apply this idea of listening to children's feelings.
That's awesome. I'll include a link to that resource in the podcast notes, and some information about that book, so that if somebody's grabbing a pencil right now, they don't have to worry about it. So when you work with inmates, parents, couples that you're working with, like I said, you know, the book, they really do, everybody needs to kind of sit and think about themselves first and where they came to this place in their own life and what measures or what strategies or tactics or parenting styles that they had on them. And they kind of do need to get that resolved and understood in their own heart, right? Before they're able to truly figure out how to then start connecting with their own children in a different way. Is that correct?
Well, I wouldn't say they need to. What I hear from parents is they almost can't help but do it. Because one of the first exercises that I give in the book, I mean, the book is intended to basically replicate the classes that I used to teach so that anyone who gets this book or does a book group together can share in that process. And to me, the most foundational process I have them do is to make a list of all the things they want for their children. All the good stuff that they really want. I have never met a parent who didn't want life to be better for their children than it was for them. And so they make that list on the left, we'll say. And then on the right-hand column, they make a list of all the things they don't want to happen to their children or to do to their children, all of the hurtful things that can happen to children. And then after they make that list, I have them go down through the want list, the things I do want for my children, and check off everything on that list that they themselves got as a child. And then I have them do the other list on the don't want list, check off everything you yourself got as a child. And for most, not all, but most parents, they immediately realize that there are way more check marks on the don't want list than there are on the do want list. And so then what I explain to them is, okay, everything you check mark on the do want list will be a parenting strength for you because you had that model and you had that experience. Everything that's not check marked will be a parenting challenge for you because you didn't have that experience. You didn't have that model. You will need to learn how to do that. And then on the right-hand list of the don't want things, those things that you checkmark will also be parenting challenges. Because if you experience that, you carry those tape recordings, it will be a challenge not to repeat those things.
Yeah.
And I think it's doing that exercise that really brings parents to that place of, oh gosh, you know, this is what I got that I don't want to pass on, and this is what I want for my children, but I had no model or experience of a lot of it. And, you know, it's sort of like an assessment of, you know, our parenting strengths and challenges. And, like, this is the roadmap. This is, you know, what it's going to take to get where we want to go.
Yeah. Well, and that resonates, you know, because I know a lot of parents will sit there and go, I want to do these things because I didn't get them as a kid. And I know I even had my own, you know, story in my head of what I definitely did not want, you know, for my children and their life growing up. And yet, and this is a story that I've shared with other people, I've been transparent about it. And it's hard to be, you know, honest to admit that, you know, you failed, you know, in some aspects of it. But here I was at 38 years old, verbatim repeating exactly the things I did not want to have happen and being utterly confused as to why they were happening. You know, it's like, I know I don't want this, but why am I doing this? Why is this going, you know, all these ways? And it come and not realizing that that was those challenges imprinted on me that I just didn't have a grasp of how to even begin to change them or improve them. And nobody around me knew what to do with, you know, with it or about it and stuff. And it's only, you know, now 7 years later, being able to get my grasp on it, which, you know, to be honest with you, is what motivates me to do like the show and to talk to people like you, is because that hurt not only myself, but I know it hurt my kids. And I don't want that for myself. I don't want that for my children. And if I can help somebody else not ever have to go through all of that, that's my mission and my purpose here. But, you know, I think that assessment that you talk about would be really enlightening. And also, I kind of see, like, you know, not everybody that listens to the show is actually a parent or maybe they're going to have kids or anything like that. They might just be trying to figure out what they want out of their own life today. And that sounds like something of, like, you know, imagine I had a theoretical child, you know, because right? A theoretical child could just be, what if I want in a partnership? Like, what kind of romantic partner do I want in my life? What do I want for them and what don't I want for them? So that sounds like that's applicable, right?
Yeah, it's pretty revealing. Yeah. I never thought of that, but I think you're right.
Yeah. One of the things that you also talk about is that, and I love this because I don't think people like frame parenting in this regard, especially when they're talking about, can I take the time to learn, respect, and understand what my child is thinking, feeling, you know, what the root of their behavior is, or can I just yell at them and put them in a timeout or spank them to get them to oblige? But you say that it takes the same amount of time, attention, and energy to meet a child's emotional needs as it does to deal with the behaviors caused by their unmet emotional needs. That when all things are said and done, you have two choices and they take the exact same energy and time out of you, but we think that coercion is the quicker path, but you're saying no, that you can take the same amount of energy to connect with your child. Is that true?
It's true. It really does. I mean, you're either going to do the work to meet their need or you're going to do the work to deal with the behavior caused by the unmet need. Either parenting is work. Either way, we're going to do the work. And, you know, a lot of parents have said to me, you know, this is not how I've been doing it. You know, how am I going to do this about face? And, you know, depending on the ages of the children, I mean, if they're still very young, you wouldn't need to do this. You just change. But if children are older, you need to sit them down and say, you know what? I've been learning some new things that I didn't know. And it makes me feel like I want to start doing things differently with you. So I'm going to be trying really hard to respond to you in a different way. And, you know, whenever, if I yell at you, you have my permission to put your hands over your ears and say, you're yelling at me and it hurts my feelings. You have my permission to do that, to help me do things in a different way. Children respond to that like you cannot believe. I mean, I've had parents come back and tell me that they've had those conversations with their kids and they just, you know, it just changed everything. It just changed everything.
Yeah, I fully see that. You mentioning the yelling and the hands over the ears. I remember one of my memories that I got in trouble in school for it was anytime the teacher, you know, in class would be, and this was like, I want to say it was like first grade and we were overseas, and the teacher, I was doing something. I couldn't even tell you what I was doing, but somehow I was wiggling in my seat or whatever it probably was as a 6-year-old or, you know, whatnot. And as soon as the teacher kind of pointed their finger at me and started to say something, my hands went up to my ears. And that was, and I realized, and I still remember that was a habit for me of covering my ears up a lot, that it just became instinct at six, seven, because it was representative of what I was dealing with in the house. Lots of yelling and screaming, right, between a couple of parents and stuff like that. And so that, you know, that impact, and it got me in trouble. And then once I got in trouble, I realized I didn't want to be in trouble. It broke my habit right away because it was a behavior I learned, which was, if you do this and block that out, you're going to get in trouble. And then that just makes things worse for you. You know, life is harder if you're, you know, not behaving. The fundamental understanding that you also think that, you know, or want parents to kind of realize is that parenting ultimately, when we have this other human, you know, in our space with us, is that the relationship at times becomes a power struggle between a child and an adult, and they are both trying to get their needs met. And, you know, depending probably on the emotional maturity of the parent, you know, you're really, parenting is that power struggle. You're trying to get them to let you have your own needs met and maybe ignoring their needs. And I think that's probably kind of like this overarching theme, is that we keep denying our children's needs and having them get met, which they absolutely need because it is the basis of the rest of their life. And in an event to, or in order for us to make sure that our needs are met, that we are able to stay on our schedule. You know, we go to dinner when we want, we clean up when we want, we, you know, wake up and get to school when we want. And so it's, you know, changing this idea that we're in this, or understanding that we have a power struggle with our kids. And that's kind of what drives everything that we've learned how to do and parent with them. Is that right?
Well, one of the things that I say is the only conflict between parents and children is conflict of needs, and that conflict arises when their needs conflict with our agenda. That's when it arises. And so if we can just understand and start to teach our children problem solving, I mean, a three-year-old can learn problem solving. You know, if you have to go to the bank before it closes, but your child doesn't want to leave the house, and so you've got conflict of needs. The child needs to just continue with doing what they're doing. They don't want to go out. They don't want to get in the car again or whatever, you know, is to say, you need this and I need this. Can we figure out a way for us both to get what we need? It's just even acknowledging it. Even if you can't get what you need, just having someone acknowledge it kind of softens that a little bit. So you might be able to say, you know, can you bring that toy in the car and we'll just do this errand really quickly? Or we might be able to reassess and say, you know, could my errand wait till tomorrow? You know, that it's not always that our needs are the highest priority or that their needs are always the highest priority. Sometimes their needs will be more immediate, but they're not more important. Mm-hmm. And so, know, striking that balance and talking about it. And, you know, then they learn how to do that with their siblings and with other children. It's like, oh, we both want this toy at the same time. How can we both get what we need? How can we problem solve? So just introducing the term problem solve into the relationship will turn things around as well.
Right. And one of the things that, you know, when you talk with, you know, I've talked with lots of different authors and therapists and researchers here, and there's that underlying, you know, by the time an adult, you know, finds their way sitting in a office with a therapist or a counselor, they're talking about how they never felt like they were ever seen or heard or understood. Like that's a resonant theme in life for people that are struggling with kind of putting some pieces back together for themselves, or that empty feeling that they can't put a finger on. And so what you're talking about here in connection parenting is, how do you acknowledge the children? Because small things like you just said, they're recognizing that they're in the, you know, having a conversation about, even at 3 years old, that, hey, I know that you want to do this. I see that you want to do this. I understand you want to do this. You know, they're getting that, and they're getting that feeling of, my parent sees me. Like that's what that means, is I see you, right?
Yes, absolutely. I see you. I hear you. I understand your feelings. I mean, that is connection.
Yeah. So if you are down to the wire, you know, with your kids, you know, I've got a 13-year-old and a 16-year-old. I didn't know any of this stuff. And I know you've said this before, you know, and I even made a little meme to share with everybody, you know, don't be ashamed of not knowing what you didn't know you didn't know. You know, we all are doing our best. Our parents were doing their best. Their parents' parents were doing their best. But when you have two teenagers and you know that there are some missteps and guides along the way, there is something I can still do, right? Like, I haven't just lost my kids and they're not doomed to the future that I have. Please tell me that that's not the case.
That is not the case. And one of the things that I say when parents ask me that too is, it's not too late. It's just too late to do it easily. when they're little, it really can be easy to do that connecting if we have the information. But if we didn't have the information, doing it when they're older is more challenging. And one of the places we have to start is that sit down to say, you know what? I just learned there were a lot of things I didn't know. And I want to try to do some things differently. But then that has to be followed up with action. One of my favorite stories of all time is a story that Stephen Covey tells in his book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective Families. He tells the story of a college professor whose son just loved baseball, eat, sleep, drink, everything baseball. But he wasn't actually a terrific baseball player. And that summer, he took his son and they visited like all these baseball stadiums across the country and just spent the summer together doing that. And in the fall, one of his colleagues was saying, oh, how was your summer? And he told him what he had done for the summer. And the colleague said, whoa, I didn't know you were that into baseball. And he said, I'm not that into baseball, but I'm that into my son.
Mm. That's awesome. Yeah, that's beautiful. So what are some things that I can, you know, you said have that conversation, and it's really that simple. I mean, I can just sit down and say, listen, I get it. Like
it's a place to start, but mm-hmm. then the next place has to be spending, having a date every week, like at least 10 minutes of connection time every day where you get to talk and listen to each other. And then a date every week. A date could be an hour, it could be an afternoon, it could be a day, you know, where you just go and do something fun. Mm-hmm. Absolute requirement in order to make that connection. Yeah. And that's how you maintain the connection. You know, if you did start early, I mean, that's what I talk about, the way that we maintain connection. The 10 minutes a day, you know, maintains the connection, but the date every week, whether it's an hour, an afternoon, or a day, you know, if you've got 4 children, you know, you're going to have to figure out how to do that. But those dates, so the daily one-on-one time and the date every week, and a date, I mean, one dad told me that his date would be to take his child out for coffee. I mean, for the child, that meant a hot cocoa and whatever. But, and one parent said, I used to go to the dump with my dad every week, and that was sacred time to us, you know? So a date doesn't have to be cost money. It doesn't have to be something huge. It's where it's just the two of you. It's one-on-one time because we're different. And I used to do this with my youngest daughter. And one time she said, oh, can my friend come on our date with us? And everything in me wanted to say, no, then it won't be our date. But I just thought, no, I'm going to go with this. And I said, yeah, sure. She goes, well, her mom doesn't do it with her, and I want her to see what it's like. And so you know what it ended up being was me chauffeuring them. And we just did it. And mm-hmm. then the next week I said, oh, is it going to be just the two of us? She goes, yeah, it wasn't the same when my friend came. You know, so she got it, that it was completely different when you added another person. So it's the one-on-one time that will build that connection.
Yeah, yeah, that's awesome. Now, and you made me think of something there when you were telling the story about the friend, because, you know, my kids all have friends. And, you know, again, we're not, you know, I'm not saying anything. Like, I think it's remarkable at this point in time that, you know, a year and a half ago, I wasn't the full-time parent, and I had my struggles with feeling comfortable in the role of mom. Like it was a big emotional thing because of, like you said, that list of challenges that I had. You know, there were some modeling pieces and things I didn't have in my life. And so while I wanted to be mom, I just didn't quite know how to pull it off and feel good, you know, feel good about what I was doing all the time. To fast forward to now, where there's, you know, tons of kids over here all the time, and they like being here. You know, there's an atmosphere to it. My kids are, you know, happy with everything that's going on here. But I do notice that every once in a while we get a child inside the walls of our house who's got it worse than I ever did and worse than what my kids ever did. And I always just, you know, wonder, is there anything I can do for those children, you know, whose, you know, moms are dealing with drug addictions or dealing with mental illness, not just, you know, going to a therapy, but having some problems with, you know, and there is a child whose mother is presently in a hospital at the moment because she's attempted suicide. And those girls, I fear for them. You know, is there something in here that we can do? Because we'll talk about this, you know, this parenting thing, this connection parenting is not something that you can do by yourself, that it does require other people to really to give you a hand with all of this, which is hard to hear as like a single mom. Like I've got some grandparents in here and their dad gets involved every once in a while, but the bulk of the time is just me and my kids. And so when I see a child without a parent that can step in and do some of the stuff, I want to know, like, what do we do? You know, is there something that can be done?
Well, that's a big challenge.
I know. I mean, sorry, Pam.
For your family personally, I mean, any time that you can include them in experiences that are, you know, nurturing and loving, I mean, just providing that is something. But in terms of in their bigger life picture, is there a way to bring resource in there? You know, that's definitely a bigger challenge, right? Because, you know, I think I was telling you earlier, I used to teach this as a 6-week class, and parents were saying to me, Pam, this is too hard. This is raising the bar too high. I can't do this. And what I finally figured out was, no, none of us can do this alone. Parenting never used to be, was never intended to be a 1 or 2 person job. We need a support system. And whether that takes the form of biological extended family or family of choice, you know, friends that we bring in to be, you know, to come for dinner and do Christmas or, you know, holidays with us or outings, we need the support of other adults. And, you know, for children who are living in families where they don't even have their primary adult and no one is stepping in, you know, unfortunately, sometimes it requires that professionals step in because it's the only help there is. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for younger children, that often means foster care. But I think teenagers, it's an even harder situation because it's not as easy for foster families to take in a teenager. Right. But fortunately, there are those who do, and that sometimes is the only recourse if there's no other family to step in and help out. Right. But in terms of the way your family can help, I think just being that safe place for them to come to is very valuable and huge for them.
Yeah, yeah. So Connection Parenting was written in 2005, but you've really evolved quite a bit through that period of time. Why don't you tell everybody what you're doing now?
Okay. Well, I kind of stopped teaching the class once the book was written and published because it's out there. You know, any person can pick it up and hopefully do it with at least one other person so you get the process part of it, or do it with a book group. And one of the things that's been a passion my whole adult life is children's books. And I learned a couple of years ago, I had no idea the statistics were as daunting as they are, that 1 in 4 children in this country is not learning to read, that 2/3 of the 15.5 million children living in poverty do not own even one book. I mean, when I ever read that, I was just, I was astounded. I just couldn't believe it. And I thought, you know what? I, even as a private citizen, can do something about this. And it just occurred to me that the children who most need books in their home are the children who also their parents are going to the food pantries, because if they don't have enough money for enough food, they certainly don't have enough money to buy children's books. And the number one indicator that children will arrive at school ready to learn to read is the number of books they had in their home in the preschool years. And so I just founded this project that is called the Book Fairy Pantry Project, and we get donations of gently used children's books donated to food pantries so that all parents will have books to read to their children. And that was kind of the beginning of it, and it has now broadened in scope tremendously in just 2 years. We're just getting, there's a project here in Maine called Books on the Bus, where they got these seat covers to go on, this one district to go on the buses with pockets in the back, and we're supplying books for the buses so children can use the bus ride to have books to read. It's just the most exciting thing I've ever done in my life. Every day I wake up and say, I don't believe this is what I get to do the rest of my life. And it dovetails so perfectly with Connection Parenting, because there is a magic elixir for connection, and it is reading aloud to a child. Mm-hmm. Instant connection, reading aloud to a child. So it really marries both of my loves to get to do this work. So I've been volunteering at the local county jail, working with parents to read aloud to their children over the phone, if that's the only kind of visit they're having with them, to maintain connection with them and be able to contribute to their literacy, which is one of my favorite projects that I'm involved in. So, yeah, I'm pretty happy that I get to continue on. So, I mean, with Connection Parenting, if people want to know more about it, really, it's just get the book. It's available on audiobook. And one of the reasons I recorded it as an audiobook, the literacy rate in prisons, the illiteracy rate, sorry, is 60 to 70%. And wow. I wanted to make sure the book was accessible to all parents, regardless of their level of literacy. So it's available on audible or audiobook. So that, and the thing that I love about audiobooks is I listen to them again and again and again, which I would never read a book probably 7 times, but there are many books I've listened to 7 times or more, because you always get something at every new listening that you didn't quite register the time before. Mm-hmm. So it's very accessible and it's very doable.
Yeah.
So I would say, you're interested, just get the book.
Well, and I liked your suggestion about doing a book club. And I think that actually, so if there's anybody out there listening to this that gets the book, you know, I know some people have parented this way, you know, and bless them for doing it. Not all of us did. But there is, you know, the idea of being able to get together and going through the exercises, because the book includes, you know, what to do with a daily journal. It has other resources. You make some really great recommendations to other books for people to read so they can get more information, other websites that they can go to kind of expand on the parts of it and stuff like that. So I do think that that's a way that this could, you know, keep going. And then you and I had talked about before we started recording here that maybe it's time to have the book reprinted and re-released with a different title, because the quote that I used to find you is what really people know this for, or it resonates with them, right?
It really is. Let's raise children who won't have to recover from their childhood has been floating around as a quote and now as a meme ever since, well, actually, even before the book was published. Many, many years ago, I wrote an article for the Canadian Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children for their Empathic Parenting Journal, and they used that quote as the cover, which unbeknownst to me until I received my copy in the mail. And that set off for me a whole amazing amount of connections with people I would never have met if it weren't for someone seeing that quote and saying, who the heck is Pam Leo? And tracking me down. Yep. And inviting me to a retreat where I met like my hero of heroes, Joseph Chilton Pierce, who wrote Magical Child. I mean, it really has opened more doors for me than I can count. And it never occurred to me when I was titling the book that should be a title. It would have seemed too long to me or something, but I'm really reconsidering that maybe that, because at the time in 2005, Connection Parenting didn't mean anything to anyone. Now the word connection is everywhere you look. Mm-hmm. But at that time, it just wasn't. So yeah, who knows what that might happen.
Well, let's see if we can get the publisher to listen and maybe they'll consider that. This has been amazing. I know that, you know, when I hit the stop record button, publish this episode, this doesn't mean you and I are not continuing our relationship and talking to each other.
Oh, for sure. I am so thrilled about the work that you are doing. I couldn't have been happier when you reached out to me. I was like, yes, this needs to happen. And I'm so glad you're doing this.
Oh, I appreciate that. Well, I mean, you even say, you know, I was telling some friends last night when I was talking to them, like right there in the book, you know, you talk about, you know, we spent all this time on research to look things up and to understand, but yet your quote is why do we spend time and money to do research and then not disseminate the results of that research? And yeah. You know, that's highlighted for me right here, because that to me is, I feel like I'm one of many ways of being able to get this information out to people. Because like I said, it's not just about, not everybody listening is actually a parent, and that's great, because that's fine. It's, we're all trying to be a better adult. And if we happen to be a parent, there's something to be, you know, gotten out of this experience and this information and knowledge that will allow them to improve upon that parenting aspect. But in the end, we all want to feel better about being on this earth with the life that we have and being happy, you know, as best as we can. And also when we're happy, we end up, that happiness and that love is shared with everyone around us, you know, when we're unhappy.
Right. One of the best things that we can do as a parent is to be a role model of a happy person.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. Pam, this has been amazing. Thank you so much for taking the time today to talk this. Yeah. So everybody, the Connection Parenting and all the links will be attached to the article, so everybody will know how to get to the book. Your Book Fairy Project, I'll have a link in there as well, so people can find out more about doing that and maybe even reaching out to you to find out how to set that up in their own community, because it's a fantastic resource. Every community has a food bank or a food pantry, yeah, as you call them out there.
And that is my dream for that project, is that it will be in every community in the country, in the world, because they all have food pantries and they all have parents who need books for their children.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that'd be great.
Yep. Awesome. Well, thank you again. And I look forward to talking to you. And I'm sure you and I will come up with some other stuff that we can keep discussing and sharing and teaching other parents out there. So thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to One Broken Mom. You can find podcast notes on my website at amiquiracone.com. And there I'll provide all links to all of the resources that we mentioned on the episode. Also, if you have any questions, comments, or ideas for other episodes, feel free to send me an email. And if you are interested in sponsoring the show, I'd love to have you be a part of the team. Finally, if you like what you hear, please share the podcast and leave a review so that others can find it. We are all here to get better together. I am the host, Ami Quercone, and as always, I am super grateful to have you as a listener. Until next time, have a great day.